We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 32, Death Eaters. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Dr. John Anthony Dunn about death and immortality in the Harry Potter series. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds Too.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions and cultural competency at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Today, we are talking about Death Eaters and, more broadly, themes of death and immortality in the Harry Potter stories. Emily, what do you think about these themes, which are pretty heavy, being at the center of a children's fantasy series? This is one of the lines that you hear from people is that it's too dark. It's too dark for kids to be, you know, talking about death in these kinds of, you know, in something that's supposed to be children's fantasy. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, I mean, I always like to say it's great for adults to be concerned and interested and involved in what kids are reading. But, you know, I think that it never bothered me in terms of, you know, handing the books to my son, because death is something he could experience at any time. And in fact, he has experienced, you know, the loss of a grandparent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't feel that way about other issues such as, you know, sexual themes or sexual content, because that really isn't something that, you know, a kid should have to deal with at a very young age, right? But death can happen to anyone at any time. Mm-hmm. And so in my view, those themes of death, especially if they're, you know, treated very carefully, which, I mean, frankly, I think they are very beautifully in Harry Potter, then that is something that's good for kids to encounter in a book before they encounter it in real life. What do you think, Katie?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you think about the way fairy tales are structured, they're often very much about mortality and death, mm-hmm. and the precariousness of one's existence. And mm-hmm. I think as a society, we've kind of exiled death to the boundaries of our culture in a right. way that's made it, you know, something that you don't talk about it, you whisper about it, and then you don't really deal satisfactorily with it. And I think it's actually really healthy for even kids to have an understanding of what it means to be mortal beings, and, you know, not in a heavy way, but just in a, you know, the sense of that this is what it is to live. And
right.
it's something that we all have to kind of figure out.
Yeah. Yeah. Tolkien said something, and I don't recall where, but it's always stuck with me. And he said books should be like clothes for kids in the sense that you buy them a little big. You know, or you make them a little big for kids so that they have room to grow in them. And that always struck me as great reading advice and great parenting advice.
Yeah, that's very wise. And I definitely believe that too. And I, as a kid, I for sure read books that were a few sizes too big.
Oh, yes.
You know, and that's good. I mean, that's why rereading is also really helpful and useful.
Yeah, indeed.
Well, great. So joining us for our conversation today is Dr. John Anthony Dunn, who holds a PhD in divinity from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. All right. Scottish school connections. Hogwarts, St. Andrews.
Love it.
There. John is Associate Professor of New Testament and Director of the Doctor of Ministry Program at Bethel Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. He has written articles about the Harry Potter series, and Emily and I met John at the Harry Potter Academic Conference. He is also co-host and editor of a theology and culture podcast called The Two Cities, which looks very, very cool. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you so much for having me, Katie and Emily.
Really great to have you on, and also as a fellow podcaster. And I should say that you've engaged with theological questions in popular culture with other series like Black Mirror, for example. You have, a book where people explored some of what was happening in Black Mirror. And we're so glad that you're in the Harry Potter community. But how did you first encounter Harry Potter? And when did you start to take it seriously as a subject of scholarly analysis?
Yeah, so I totally grew up in that kind of classic Potter panic scenario where Harry Potter was evil, never read it, growing up kind of thing. I didn't read it until 2009, so 2 years after Deathly Hallows came out. I was 22. When I grew up in that setting where it was evil, I actually had no interest really in reading literature, period. I didn't really care for it because in that setting, all kinds of secular literature was dubbed secular, right? So don't mess with it. Don't worry about it. Don't concern yourself with it. And so I just never really had an interest in it, to be honest. And I was in grad school at the time in 2009. I actually was about to propose to somebody. I'd bought a ring for someone, and kind of unexpectedly, she told me she wasn't ready to get married. And we had actually been planning to get married for some time. And in that kind of, turmoil of that, right, the unexpected, I really didn't know what to do. This was in the summer, and I had a lot of kind of academic plans for that summer. I wanted to kind of get ahead on a class I was going to take in the fall and just really start researching for a paper I knew I was going to write because I'm that nerdy. But I just lost all motivation and interest in doing that. And so I had this overwhelming feeling like I wanted to read fiction, which is strange, I have to say, because that wasn't, again, my context or background. I didn't have any experience doing that, but I had this overwhelming sense like I wanted to read fiction, and I didn't want to read just a singular book or a one-off. I had this feeling like I wanted to read a series. And in that kind of moment, I remembered all of these recommendations, like, you would really love Harry Potter if you gave it a chance kind of thing. And so I just said, all right. So I went to a bookstore. I bought the box set. I bought all seven, and I read them in the next 3 weeks. And it was one of the best decisions I ever made. It really was one of the best decisions I ever made. And it was a pivotal experience for me because not only did it help me process and move on, but it really gave me this whole new appreciation for literature and storytelling and narrative. And so I just became, a huge fan, but it really was just a fan. So in terms of Harry Potter scholarship, what happened was I went and did my PhD in Scotland, as you mentioned. And my first year, there was actually an academic Harry Potter conference. It was the UK's first academic Harry Potter conference at the University of St. Andrews. And I was so excited to attend. And the day that the abstracts were due, one of the organizers, he was in the divinity school as well, he came to my office and he's like, John, abstracts are due today. Where's your abstract? And I was like, I'm not submitting an abstract. I'm just going to attend. Like, I'm really excited to be there. I'm a fan and that's it, And he's like, no, you're like the biggest Harry Potter fan here. You have to present. And it just never occurred to me. So I cleared my desk and I thought about it for an hour or two, and I came up with something and submitted an abstract, and it was accepted. And I gave a paper, and it was basically about the use of 1 Corinthians 15, the last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. On the tombstone of Lily and James Potter there in the Godric's Hollow chapter of Deathly Hallows. I really wanted to explore that because I was a divinity student. I was studying the Apostle Paul. So I just thought, oh, okay, intertextuality with Paul's writings. This is like right up my alley. And I could talk about what does this verse mean within the context of Harry Potter. And so that was the paper that I presented at that conference. It was thankfully later published in the Proceedings volume, Ravenclaw Reader.
Yeah, the Ravenclaw Reader. Mm-hmm. Yes, I have that book. Absolutely. And
that's
the
right.
Title of the article is The Death of Death in the Death of the Boy Who Lived.
That's
the
right.
Morality of mortality in Harry Potter.
Yeah, and that's another kind of homage to a classic writing by a Puritan named John Owen, The Death of Death and the Death of Christ. So I kind of wanted to make some connections there of the kind of Christological imagery, but really what that was all about was kind of making sense of that verse. And so, you know, from very early on, I was interested in the topic of death and chose to do that. And from then, you know, after that conference, I found out about Chestnut Hill, and I've just been sort of active on the side, you know, because by training, I'm a Bible scholar, right? So on the side, I've been very interested in continuing Harry Potter research, and mostly related to themes of death and immortality.
Right. And I think the Harry Potter Academic Conference is so good, because if you just get in the routine of like, this is a conference that I go to, you do tend to end up thinking about, oh, maybe I could do this. Right.
And that would be good for Chestnut Hill. Yeah. Because, you know, there are these short little 15-minute presentation blocks for most of us. And yeah, you can't do everything in that, you know? And so sometimes an idea will strike me and I'm like, ooh, I could do that in 15 minutes.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I'm so interested in what you said about how you got interested in Harry Potter, and the fact that when you're going through a difficult time, somehow it came to you that fiction would be a refuge or something. I respond so much to that, because I definitely feel that, you know, that sense of, you know, that fiction, it gets you out of yourself, but it also gives you perspective on yourself at the same time. And and I had that same, not that same, I had a similar experience in that, like, I read Harry Potter in graduate school, which was, I was having a horrible time, and it was just a wonderful place to escape to. And then I was like, oh, but maybe there are things happening in here that are interesting and worth exploring. But it took me a while to get to the scholarship part as well.
It's not always an escape. I mean, it is an escape, but it's also a liberation from, you know,
right.
And that, again, that goes back to Tolkien saying, if a man is in prison, you know, why blame him if he wants to escape, you know, if he wants to get out and be free, you know, it's like, don't we all? And so, And so in some senses, you know, this escape leads to a way of looking at your life and your circumstances in a way that is liberating and helps you through the difficult time rather than just, you know, shoving it under the rug.
I admire your restraint in feeling that Harry Potter was evil and taboo and shouldn't be read, and then you didn't actually read it when you thought that, because if you want me to read something, you tell me it's evil and taboo, because I will then be going and reading it. So I just wanted to say, I marvel at your restraint there. That's all you have to do to make me interested in something is, you know, try to tell me not to read it. So that's my nature.
John, I was just saying to somebody, I was playing Mass last weekend for the Feast of the Epiphany, and so we were playing We Three Kings, and I realized I had to play all the first four verses of the hymn, because verses 2, 3, and 4 talk about the three different gifts, and I think myrrh is the coolest gift. So I was like, I can't leave this off, even though, you know, the song should end. We're just going to sing this verse too. And I was telling this to our deacon, and I was like, you know, because myrrh is the coolest one, but I guess that makes me sort of a dark person. And he just goes, yes, you are. So I was like, okay, so I'm obsessed with death and I'm sort of a dark person. But John, you don't seem like a dark person. Like, that explains me. But tell us about why you were drawn to this series focus on death in your scholarship.
Right. Yeah. I'm not a dark person. If people know personality types, I'm an Enneagram 7, which means actually I don't like pain and suffering and all of these things. I run away from it. I pursue joy and pleasure. That's kind of the personality type.
You're very sunny. I think 7. You have a sunny personality, I would say. Yeah.
Right. I think it's maybe this sort of I'm drawn to this thing that, like, I'm supposed to be repelled by, perhaps, in my research. I'm not entirely sure. But to be honest, I think what it all goes back to is that experience of being near to proposing to somebody and being engaged. So I think in that experience, what happened was, you know, I realized that there was a death of a life that I thought I was going to have, that there was a death of a relationship. You know, it wasn't literal bereavement, but it was a kind of bereavement that actually led me to Harry Potter. And I think at its core, that's what Harry Potter is. It has bereavement as its central sort of issue. I think it was the case for Rowling herself, right? She finds out that her mother has terminal MS and the boy wizard meets her on a train, right? And I think this, the text as well, is addressing bereavement, obviously, quite clearly throughout. And so I just think, to be honest, I had a kind of bereavement experience. And so I just naturally latched on to the exploration of that in the series.
Well, there's this fan theory that is about death and the death figure in the Tale of the Three Brothers. And I don't know if probably listeners have heard this because it's been around for a while now, where, you know, each of the three brothers represents a character. And then the death figure is thought to be Dumbledore, who has the different Hallows in his possession at various times and is kind of distributing them. And so this is one of the most common ideas about death, like, that circulates, you know, in the fan community. What do you think about that, you know, little allegory there that Dumbledore represents death?
Yeah, so I love the Tale of the Three Brothers. I think it's fantastic. But I do think that, at least the way this fan theory is sort of articulated, I don't think it works. And it actually has got a lot of traction, especially like on Reddit and different forums, Twitter, these sorts
and
of things.
J.K. Rowling said it fits.
That's right. That's right. So she was asked in 2015, you know, what's your favorite fan theory? And she said, Dumbledore as death. You know, it's beautiful and it fits. And I think what's really interesting about that is the way that a lot of people respond, because they think authorial intent is really all that matters. They say, look, she's the one who says it fits, so let's go with that. But I think actually the line "it fits" betrays authorial intention, because it shows that she never intended this.
Yes.
Yeah,
exactly.
It shows that, you know, she can appreciate it, but it's not what she had in mind. Like, she doesn't say, you're right, you guessed it, you figured it out.
Right, right. But she says it can be crammed in.
Yeah, you can make that work. Yeah, but I would actually say you really can't make it work. So the way that the theory is sort of constructed, and I should say that the way I was first exposed to this was I was listening to a MuggleCast episode, and I don't remember which one it was, but in that episode, they were talking about personifications of death and specifically this theory. So I'm listening to it like while I'm driving, and they were really happy about this theory. And they were like, and at the end, they were like, you know, if Dumbledore doesn't represent death or personify death, then nobody in this series does. And I was actually really upset, because my Ravenclaw reader article was about how Voldemort represents death. I'll say something about that in a second. But I was like, I'm going to write them a letter. And I was like, no, I'm going to write a Chestnut Hill conference paper.
So. All right.
Yes. I can do that in 15 minutes.
Yeah. So that's what happened there. But the way that the way that this is typically articulated is that Dumbledore represents death in the Tale of the Three Brothers. It's kind of this allegory. You've got, you know, the first brother is all about the wand, so that's Voldemort. The second brother is all about the Resurrection Stone, that's Snape. And the third brother is all about the cloak, and that's Harry. The problem with this sort of breakdown, well, first of all, it's not a prophetic story, right? It's about the past. I think that's important. But additionally, when you sort of think of it this way, it doesn't make sense to attribute the second brother to Snape. The person who's kind of most closely associated with the Resurrection Stone would surely be Dumbledore, actually, not Snape, given his use of it, right? And actually, it leads to his downfall. But even as well, what a lot of people like to do is they think about how, you know, Harry is a descendant of the third brother. Harry uses the cloak. He's kind of known for the cloak. But Voldemort's a descendant of the second brother. So if we're going to make that connection, why don't we associate Voldemort with the Resurrection Stone by that sort of line of thought? But additionally, there are other characters who use the cloak, and Harry doesn't use the cloak like the third brother does. The third brother uses the cloak to evade death. Harry doesn't, right? And
yeah, he takes off the cloak to meet death.
That's right. That's right. And within within that final book, when they first hear the tale of the three brothers, Hermione's like, oh, it's so clear, you know, which one is the best? And they all answer at the same time with different answers, right? Hermione right. says, Hermione's the one who says it's the cloak. Ron says it's the wand. And Harry says it's the resurrection stone. So if we were to think about that, Harry's own preference in terms of evading death would be the resurrection stone. It would not be the cloak. So I just don't think it works. And then additionally, if we were to talk about, okay, why would we want to say Dumbledore personifies death? This is kind of actually the crux of the Ravenclaw reader essay that I wrote, that original presentation at St. Andrews that I gave. It's that part of the problem with that verse, 1 Corinthians 15, where it says that death is an enemy and death will be destroyed. Part of the problem with that is Harry's reaction to it, right? He says that's a Death Eater idea. Because all throughout the series, we've actually been led to think the opposite, right? We've been told that death is the next great adventure. It's quicker and easier than falling asleep, you know, these sorts of things. And the way that you kind of get that sort of positive appreciation of death, it makes total sense that you could sort of begin to see a character like Dumbledore sort of embodying that, perhaps. But I don't think that really works, especially not with 1 Corinthians 15. If death is an enemy and he's the last one, right, to be destroyed, I would say that part of what's going on there is a kind of allusion to the destruction of Horcruxes that culminates in, quote unquote, the last enemy, that last sort of the boss, if you will, after all of these previous enemies have been destroyed, the previous Horcruxes. So it seems to fit more to think of Voldemort as a personification of death, the person whose name in French, Voldemort, you know, either means flight of death or flight from death. And I sort of think that, you know,
John, it can also mean steal from death.
Oh, okay.
Which could, I, that's one that people don't say a lot, but vole also means to steal in French. And I think you make this argument too, that he's trying to become a pupil of death. A student of death. And so he's kind of stealing death's role as a way to make himself immortal.
Absolutely. And I would say that the way that I would want to most articulate his personification of death is that he's a mortal personification of death. He represents death not wanting to die, which is at the heart of 1 Corinthians 15, 26, right? The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. Death is personified as the thing that can die. And so that's what I'd want to say about Voldemort, is that he's not like the Grim Reaper of the tale of the three brothers, so to speak, right? That kind of version of death. He is this mortal personification of death. He's death not wanting to die. You know, he's the one who everybody euphemistically refers to as know who. Like we were talking just a moment ago about how death is something that you whisper, right? When you think about, nobody wants to take seriously the reality of Voldemort's return and the fact that Voldemort returned and you know, killed somebody at Hogwarts. There's a kind of metaphor there for acknowledging death and how death came to Hogwarts, right? And I do think that there's something about the euphemistic sort of treatment of Voldemort in the first couple of books, and especially the way that in Order of the Phoenix, they don't want to fully acknowledge his return. I think there's a metaphor there with how we treat death.
Right. And he who must not be named, right? So exactly. not even calling him by name, and the way that people have euphemisms for death, right? Exactly. Where they say somebody passed or
kick the bucket.
Pushing up daisies.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I was interested in that idea, partly because when I was advertising Harry Potter for Nerds 2 book, which came out about the same time as the Ravenclaw Reader, I did a kind of promotional conversation with Amy Sturgis about whether Dumbledore represents death in the three brothers. And I was like, no. And so I emailed John before the podcast. I was like, just out of curiosity, what do you think about this? And thankfully, we're not in violent disagreement with each other. Because I will throw down over this, but obviously you will too, John, but we're on the same side. So that's right. Cool.
That's good. Right. No fights necessary. Yeah. I always thought the whole theory gave Dumbledore a little bit too much credit too. Like, you know, actually he's just a guy.
He's flawed.
I mean, yeah, he's flawed. I mean, on the literal level of the story, he's just a guy, you know, but at the same time, you know, I mean, I've made the argument that he represents God, but that's quite different from death. You know, I mean, there's a real distinction there in terms of, yeah, well, that's another podcast.
Yeah. Right. So, but I did a Chestnut Hill conference paper where I wrote this paper with my psychology professor colleague, Mark Sabicki, because he had given a talk to my church group, Unitarian Universalists were interested in all the stuff. And he talked about death in psychology and particularly what's called terror management theory, which is this idea that basically all the things we do are because we're scared we're going to die. And we don't want to die. And so we looked at the tale of the three brothers, particularly as it represents different coping mechanisms for people experiencing the terror of our own mortality. And, you know, in that sense, you know, it gives it a little bit of it's about coping mechanisms. And ultimately, we said that the books themselves are kind of giant coping mechanism for kind of understanding our mortality, which I think, John, is sort of in line with what you're talking about as well.
I completely agree. I think that's fascinating. And, you know, something that Emily said earlier about how, you know, she was talking about liberation, that the books aren't merely an escape. I always say that it's not an escape. It was an education for me. Right. I love that line. Love that line when Dumbledore says, you know, of course it's all happening in your head, but why on earth should that mean that it isn't real? Right. There's something formational that is happening. And it makes sense that we would talk about it in terms of education, given the nature of the series.
Right. Right. I mean, I'm steeped in the Christian tradition and, you know, I feel like the best of our thinking on what the church is this school, you know, the school of discipline, you know, for learning, you know, the right sort of human yearnings. Right. And taking a pass on the rest, you know, and so much of that does relate to death. I remember I had a student in my comparative religions course, I asked them, you know, we were trying to kind of set terms at the beginning of the semester. And I said, you know, what is religion? And this one student raised her hand. And I learned later that she's totally non-religious. She was raised in a totally non-religious household. But she said, it's a coping mechanism. And, I think there was like gasps around the classroom, like, because I think some other students thought that she was going to like get in trouble for saying that, or that I was going to be personally offended because they knew that I'm religious. And I was like, that's a really brilliant answer. That's a really objectively wonderful answer, you know? And so we talked a lot about why she said that and, you know, because religion does function in those ways. And of course, John, when you were giving your paper at Chestnut Hill last year, I told you I'm your target audience for this because I'm so interested in these religious themes and especially how they come into play with how we cope with death and these ancient understandings of death itself in religious thinking and how we cope with it. So talk to us about how the Death Eaters in Harry Potter relate to ancient religious conceptions of death.
That's a great question. And, you know, I was fascinated by Death Eaters a lot this past year because I've been working on a passage in the book of Isaiah from the Old Testament Hebrew Bible that talks about this great banquet that that everybody will participate in when God restores all things. Everybody will be eating the finest of wine and eating the best food in the world. And what's the meal placed before God at this great banquet? It's death. God's going to eat death. And the reason why I've been fascinated by this is because I'm writing a book on alcohol in the Bible. And so this is obviously a really interesting passage for me. But as I was thinking about this idea of like, wait, God's eating death. God's a death eater, right?
Isn't that a death eater idea?
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Isn't that a death eater idea? Exactly. So I started thinking about this idea of death eaters a little bit more, right? What does it really mean? Because in the series, you actually don't get a clear articulation. I think we assume we know what it means to be a Death Eater, but it's not clear, right? So I wanted to kind of explore this. And I sort of said, well, there's at least two ways we could think about it. We could think about Death Eaters in a subjective sense, that Death Eaters are people who want to act like death and eat, or they are people who want to eat death, and that would be an objective understanding. So this kind of subjective or objective sort of interpretation. What's interesting about that objective interpretation, as I've mentioned, God eats death in this passage in Isaiah. Well, when you look at broader sort of Canaanite, Ugaritic mythology, this is a really common trope that there's this figure who's basically an embodiment of death who just consumes and eats. So the god Mot in Ugaritic mythology is just this insatiable eater who cannot stop eating. Wow. And he represents death. He represents the underworld. And if you think about this idea of like death as this kind of thing that can't stop eating and consumes it, you know, you start thinking maybe a little bit more anthropologically about like burial practices, right? If you're putting people into mm-hmm. the ground and then the ground sort of swallows them up. And mm-hmm. even in the Bible, you have Sheol referred to in this way that, you know, the ground opens up and consumes people. So this idea of
or like, even like being eaten by worms or whatever.
Oh,
right?
Totally.
That
you, sure.
Right. Yeah. Being consumed.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So this idea of like the fate of death as consumption is just really, really fascinating. And so as I was thinking about this more within Harry Potter, obviously the idea of taking Death Eaters in an objective way, I think makes most sense. And I think probably most Harry Potter fans would agree with this, is that they want to eat death itself. They want to be higher up on the food chain, so to speak, to be greater than death. And it's an image of immortality in that sense. And it would make sense for them to do that because the person that they are following is famously pursuing immortality. So Death Eaters as this idea that they want to eat death, consume death, it is interesting because it does fit a lot of what we see of divine activity, right? This is what Mot is known for in Ugaritic theology. And what's interesting about that Isaiah passage then, it's a way of saying that thing that eats, that thing that cannot stop eating will itself be eaten one day. Right. And that's just actually this really beautiful image. And then if we were to sort of transpose that to Harry Potter, wow, the hubris of calling themselves Death Eaters, right? The hubris, which I think is intuitive that it's hubristic, obviously. But I think there's this kind of greater connotation to it because it's divine activity to eat death.
Wow, that's really powerful, right? Yeah. And I think about that with the Death Eaters, like you say, it's prideful to the nth degree, and it feels like power to them, but it is really such an overreach that it is actually not just blasphemous, but it's ultimately their downfall.
Absolutely. I just found it all fascinating, John. I was on the edge of my seat during your talk. But then again, we've already established I'm a dark person.
Well, and I didn't realize there were all those ancient views of, you know, death eating, like and sort of the gaping maw of death, the pit of death that is itself consuming. And I think that's, you know, and I was just talking about terror management theory. I think it's Ernest Becker who said that that death is the worm at the core of the human experience. And so that's the same kind of the consumption metaphor there. That we are deeply bothered by.
Mm-hmm. And she loves to use food as, as in symbolic ways. And it does seem like food can be used in a really positive way, where food is described as delicious and wonderful. And she gives all these details that make your mouth water, you know, and send you straight to the grocery. And then food can also be rancid. I mean, the death day party, you know, they're eating rancid food, and there's certain moments in which the trio receive, you know, food that's bad, you know, and it turns out to be a warning that the person who gave it to him is no good, you know. So like Xenophilius Lovegood gives them the tea or whatever it is that slop they're drinking, and infusion of gurdy root or something, and it tastes awful, right? And of course he, you know, in the next turn he turns him over to the Death Eaters. And so, you know, but then, you know, Aberforth Dumbledore gives them bread and cheese and mead, and you know, they're starving, you know, and so they're eating that, and he's a true ally, right? Because of, and the food he gives them is true. So it is an interesting sort of kind of part of this complex of symbols surrounding food in the series. It's really fascinating.
Yeah. And the, you know, the series itself has, I think, the Hallows as one set of responses to death, but of course Voldemort's Horcruxes are a dark arts response to death and mortality. How, John, does the concept of Horcruxes relate to things that we might see in our modern day culture related to transhumanism, this quest for technologies that would promise human immortality? You know, like, you know, that you would freeze your body after you died, mm-hmm. and then you could be brought back to life. Or I don't know if you've seen, you must have seen that series, John, Upload.
Oh, love
that
Upload
series. It's hard for me to watch. I find it so grotesque, the idea that you would literally like upload your consciousness into, you know, some sort of digital realm. But, you know, Horcruxes and transhumanism are absolutely, you know, related to each other. How are they linked, and what is this, what's the Harry Potter series saying about them?
Right. Yeah. So I have a huge interest in this area of kind of technological immortality. We could sort of, you know, conceive of it as it's part of the book that I edited on Black Mirror and theology. And my interest in Upload is related to all of this. I have this article that is available as advanced access through the Journal of Religion and Popular Culture, published by the University of Toronto, on this topic, and I believe it'll be formally published in the next issue of the journal.
Right, and called, I'll just say the title for people: Harry Potter and the Aims of Transhumanism: A Magical Critique of Technological Immortality. Very
right.
Cool.
Right. The more that I study transhumanism, and I should, you know, say what this is, but the more that I study transhumanism, I just felt, you know, Harry Potter really stands out as a kind of anti-transhumanist text, at least in terms of the most ambitious aims of transhumanism. So what is transhumanism? Mm-hmm. Transhumanism is this idea that perhaps through technology, we could advance our species, upgrade ourselves technologically in a number of possible ways. And as one major aim of that, we could potentially overcome, or at least transcend or postpone death. And so there's kind of three supers that are often associated with transhumanism. So super intelligence, super well-being, and super longevity. So super longevity is this idea of kind of living indefinitely, maybe achieving a kind of amortality, not quite immortality, but at least an amortality where we won't die naturally. Perhaps we would, of course, still be able to be murdered, or, you know, when the universe dies, we will die, kind of thing. But the idea of super longevity is this is kind of extreme extension of life. And so I just really think Harry Potter kind of at a surface level pushes against such an ambition. Of course, we see Voldemort pursue this, but Voldemort's not the only one who pursues it. And that's what I think is kind of interesting, not just that he's not the only one who pursues it, but that all other pursuits of super longevity within Harry Potter are critiqued, and mm-hmm. sort of the non-pursuit of those aims is really, really kind of valorized.
Well, it's interesting, you know, when you were talking about this, and I was thinking about like Nicholas Flamel.
Exactly.
You know, and exactly. Dumbledore, yeah. And they're working together with the Sorcerer's Stone or the Philosopher's Stone. And it's not exactly negative, but it does end up being somewhat negative.
Right. I think it's really interesting what Dumbledore says about the stone. You know, he doesn't speak as highly of it as you might expect. You know, he's like, you know, people are going to pursue all this money and life, and it's actually the things that are worse for them, you know? And I think that there's something about the Philosopher's Stone too, the way that Flamel destroys it when he's 665 years old, right? It's it's as if to say to live any longer would be evil, right?
Yeah,
it's
not, yeah.
Like the fact that he's extended his life that much is nearly bad, right? It's right. nearly evil. And so there is something even there, and he's a good guy, right? There's something even about his pursuit of super longevity that the series actually does critique. So it's not just the pursuit of Horcruxes. What I think is interesting about Horcruxes, though, is the way that Voldemort puts his soul in these physical objects. That really is a great analogy for what we're talking about with a show like Upload, or some things that we see in Black Mirror, this idea of sort of digitally downloading our minds from our biological substrate, our brains, to a supercomputer of some kind where we can live as embodied avatars in this kind of digital space, and sort of, you know, have this kind of extension of life in this virtual world, right? I think there's something about the downloading of the soul, so to speak, of Voldemort in these Horcruxes that is a great analogy for that pursuit. And of course, the Horcrux of it all is clearly evil. No, you know, we don't want to sort of say transhumanists are guilty by association. They have the exact same sort of villainous intentions. That's not the case. Transhumanism builds off of humanism. It has at its core very humanist goals, and it's not, you know, about murdering people and then, you know, so anyways,
just right, or be, even just really be becoming godlike. I read a little bit about transhumanism for the essay that that I've written about Mr. Weasley's Flying Ford Anglia, believe it or not. But yes. But the idea that I shared that with you, John, because your transhumanism stuff was interesting for me. But that transhumanists, they see death as an evil, and why mm-hmm. do we have to experience this? And it is, you know, they see it as just a you know, a great positive that enhances humanity and allows us to carry on. And it's a kind of a hopeful vision. Like you say, it's not, they're not death eaters. Like, yeah. You know, they're not like, you know, Lucius Malfoy, you know, with Dark Mark and all that.
Right. Or Emperor Palpatine. It's more mm-hmm. of a Star Trek thing, more Star Trek than anything mm-hmm. else. You know, it's that hopeful idea of what might be for the human race.
Mm. Right. 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 But I think Harry Potter contains within it kind of rejection of the desire for it is what I would say. I think it's there in the Mirror of Erised conversation. And I think it's there through the exploration of all types of characters, not least Dumbledore himself, who is ultimately in the end kind of led astray by this and dies as a result of it, you know, or at least, you know, his death was sort of inevitable because of it. Right. And so that situation that he worked out with Snape, you know, wouldn't have been necessary unless he was in this situation where he was led astray by these kind of magical pursuits of immortality, in his case the resurrection stone in that final sequence for him,
right? And even the invisibility cloak, like the idea of that is not to keep that forever but to pass it down through generations. Mm-hmm. And that's a different kind of immortality than the immortality of the individual.
Yeah, speaking of the individual, I really agree with Emily's work on this, actually. She has an essay in the volume that's forthcoming, The Ivory Tower and Beyond, about how really parenting is sort of put forward as really the only kind of legitimate form of immortality. And one of the ways in which you see that, not least, is through the parallel of how many children the Weasleys have versus, you know, the Horcruxes that that Voldemort has. And there is something about the epilogue then that becomes, I think, crucial to how we should interpret the series in terms of death and immortality. It really is about that passing on to the next generation, as you were saying, Katie.
Yeah, and I do find that really interesting that she's engaging with, you know, not just the inevitability of death, but like then, you know, but what else? Right. So she's not, you know, it's not coming at you as that you must accept death, but there is this, you know, there is this idea of the, I don't know, the consolations of being mortal that come through, you know, families and generations.
Mm-hmm. And this is why I think The Cursed Child is just completely wrong from the get-go. There is no way that Voldemort would have a child for all of these reasons related to immortality and really the kind of hyper individuality that Voldemort sort of embodies.
Right. Or Bellatrix Lestrange, really. I mean, it's just too hopeful of a thing to do for either of those two, you know. No, I think that's absolutely spot on. And you know, because she doesn't give much of a glimpse of the afterlife, right? Because, mm-hmm. I mean, I think that would probably cross the lines that she's drawn for herself in terms of being, you know, creating a series that's overtly religious, right? It's not an overtly religious series. It's a sort of symbolically or hidden, you know, it's religious in a hidden sort of way, which is fascinating. It's almost like a puzzle to solve in many ways. But the one thing that she is clear about is how we do live on in the generations that follow. And mm-hmm. I think that's a lovely message. And it's maybe even more of an inclusive message for many members of the human race. You know, I'm not everybody, but you know, it's interesting. Well, John, I really want to talk about the Christmas pig, because I got super excited in your talk at Chestnut Hill when you were talking about death as this endless consumption, you know, this mm-hmm. idea of endless consumption, because I had read her Christmas story that I think came out 2 years ago at Christmas, called The Christmas Pig, which is really an adorable, you know, story. It's actually darker and sort of has more depth to it than I expected, really from page one almost. But the villain, the loser in mm-hmm. the story, is this gigantic, you know, robot type creature. It's unclear whether it is a robot or not, but it's made up of all of the lost things, all of the thrown away unwanted items that humans have tossed and that this creature has eaten, you know, has consumed. And it's made up of the larger, you know, the more durable of these things. And it goes around eating all of these lost, unwanted things.
Yeah, and it's in an underworld kind of context.
Yes.
Oh yeah, with the fire at the heart.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I was like jumping out of my seat while you were talking about these ancient religious images of death as the all-consuming force. So now you've read The Christmas Pig.
Yes.
And so tell me what you thought of it.
Right. I'm really grateful for your recommendation, because it really fits a lot of what I was seeing in Harry Potter. And I hadn't read it. I actually hadn't even heard of it. So I loved reading through it. You know, just for some context, if people haven't read The Christmas Pig. So The Christmas Pig is about this kid named Jack, who at Christmas time, around Christmas time, he loses his pet toy pig thing. And he gets a replacement toy, this Christmas pig. And on Christmas Eve, it's like this, you know, kind of night in which all the things come alive, and it's this magical time or whatever. And Jack is told that there is this realm where all lost things go. Whenever you lose something, it goes there. And depending on how much you loved that thing, it would be in a different sort of sphere. So I like to say that The Christmas Pig is really what you would get if you crossed Toy Story and the Dante's Divine Comedy. It's got this like rings of hell sort of thing going on. And it very much is an underworld. I mean, they descend down into this space, and even they talk about up there. They talk about the world up there. And when Jack learns about kind of the fate of the lost things and how their ultimate fate, and it's the point of no return in which the lost thing will never, ever be found again, is when the loser consumes it. And what the Christmas pig says is it's what people up there call death, which is just so spot on in what we're talking about.
Yeah.
The fact that there's this monstrous creature at the core of this underworld who consumes. I mean, that is Mot. That is the Canaanite god of death. Mm. That is exactly what we're talking about. This personification of death. And so I loved it. I thought it was just a very fitting way to imagine death. And it shows, I think, that she was thinking about death in some of these ways by even talking about Death Eaters as Death Eaters.
Right. So yes. She's got a kind of consistency there in terms of the, you know, the metaphors that she's choosing. And I do think that she, like you say, it's like Toy Story meets the Divine Comedy. But I mean, I think knowing the kind of author and reader J.K. Rowling is, like, that's very possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that she sort of seems to pick up a lot of these things, and she seems to know a lot that she then, you know, patches together in these really interesting ways that bring them back to us in a way that's really fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if I can throw in, you know, you talked, John, earlier about the role of bereavement and how the series is really centrally concerned with bereavement. And I thought, I found this, I was rereading a bits of The Christmas Pig this morning, and I found this line in chapter 35, The Loser. It says, "The loser let out a terrible cry that shook the ground and made the boulders tremble. It was a howl of fury, but also of anguish, as though he'd lost something he loved and would never, ever get back." And I just made me think, wow, this is not just commentary on death. This is commentary on loss and grief and what it can do to us, you know. And it, you know, it almost, and this character of Holly in the story also is definitely symbolic of what pain and suffering and loss can really do to a person, how it can turn a person, you know, into some evil version of themselves that they then have to try to recover at some point. Yeah, that they have to try to recover that better version of themselves. And of course she does in the course of the story, which is wonderful to read, but yeah, it struck me as almost building compassion for, rather than totally demonizing death, rather there's this little glimpse of why we should maybe have compassion for this point of view.
Listeners, remember we did an episode on The Christmas Pig, episode 17. And Emily, when you and I talked about it, we talked about how there is that both Holly and Jack are dealing with a kind of bereavement in that their parents had gotten divorced. So they're step siblings, right? And so they're in this new combined family. And so there is a kind of bereavement of the old family that they had. And then when you throw in the bereavement for Der Pig, the little stuffed animal pig that kind of represented his comfort amid all that loss, you get that sense. And I'm just struck by how this connects, John, with how you got into Harry Potter in the first place, right? That it was the loss of a relationship and a kind of future that you were expecting. And I feel like that's what these kids in The Christmas Pig are dealing with as well, with all of this, like you say, bereavement imagery.
Yeah, no, I don't have anything to say in response, just that I totally agree.
Yeah, so when we're thinking particularly about The Christmas Pig, there is this idea of, you know, consumption, and we've been talking a lot about this, consumption, death, immortality, and these are also in line with Harry Potter, right? That we've got this kind of consuming aspect of death. John, how do you think this relates? What should those of us in the modern world take from this, given that we are in this late stage capitalism phase that is, in fact, a lot about consuming production and consumption?
I think Harry Potter speaks to this in a couple of ways. And I think, you know, just the idea, this kind of hyper individualistic, person at the heart of the story who is trying to live forever, who's sort of hoarding life in this way. This is something that, as I mentioned earlier, Dumbledore explicitly rejects when he talks about the Philosopher's Stone. You know, he says the stone wasn't really such a wonderful thing, as much money and life as you could want, the two things that human beings would choose above all. The trouble is, humans do have a knack of choosing precisely those things that are worse for them. And what's interesting about that is, where does money come from, right? I mean, we're talking about this dude who's living for a long time. So I think Rowling has, at least there, brought the two together, this pursuit of immortality. And there is a kind of sort of pursuit of wealth. At least we could think of it in terms of accumulation and hoarding, right? So this idea of consumption, not merely about ingesting, but kind of hoarding life, hoarding money, resources, right? Viewing the world as a repository of stuff that I can just take and accumulate for me and myself. You know, we obviously have a knack of this. I think of 2020 and the toilet paper crisis, just hoarding things right. Hoarding things that we don't need. We just, no other animal on the planet accumulates and hoards like we do, right? Animals take what they need and then they come back when they need more. But we just hoard and hoard and hoard and hoard. And so I think there is something here connected to the accumulation and hoarding of life that we're talking about, that is at least in that comment by Dumbledore is explicitly connected to hoarding and accumulating money, which I think is really interesting.
Right. And I think when you think about alchemy, eternal life and riches are connected together in the alchemical pursuits. And so I always thought it was kind of funny that you would have something that was like a fountain of youth that's also supposed to make you incredibly rich. That those things are often connected in the way that we imagine what would be like our wildest human fantasies. And then of course, capitalism, I guess, kind of offers those things up as possibilities. And mm-hmm. it's not only the hoarding of wealth, but also the hoarding of life. And I think that's one of the things that you point out with transhumanism, that you could potentially get these inequalities mm-hmm. where, people who have more money can have
yes.
more immortality.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the kind of inequities that we might imagine if transhumanist technologies were possible is pretty scary to think about, right? That the mm-hmm. that the wealthy would have access and there'd be this stratification in society along the lines of rich and poor about who has access to these technologies, which is definitely terrifying, and this connection between life and money, you brought up alchemy, which is great because the alchemical result that we're, that's being pursued is gold. Right. Mm-hmm. And so this connection is right there overtly. And of course the accumulation of wealth is not something that you could take with you after you die. So if you prize money, you're going to need to have a long and potentially unending life, right? If wealth is going to be your greatest pursuit.
But that's the thing about alchemy, is that there's really two ways of looking at it. There's the way that, kind of history of, chemistry or whatever, science looks at it in terms of it's kind of this quirky, weird thing to do where you pursue this, unending gold and unending life. But there was this spiritual aspect of it, obviously, mm-hmm. Where it was the idea that through the identification of the elements, the alchemists themselves transforms from a primitive state of consciousness to a more divine state of consciousness, and thus realizes their own immortality in Christ. And so it's almost like this discipline that's like has this huge potential pitfall of leading you into pursuit of material goods and physical immortality, but the real point of it was to understand, to identify with your consciousness and to identify with God, to identify with the divine and to become the divine. And so it's this thing, it's like a test, to see which way are you going to take this? Are you going to take this in the physical way, the literal way? Or are you going to take this in the spiritual way?
Right.
And it's the spiritual alchemist who is the hero of the story.
Right, right. Right. And at least the way that Dumbledore is talking about this particular alchemist in that moment when he says this, right, Nicholas Flamel, it's almost as if we could take it as that alchemist has not learned the lesson of alchemy in terms of personal spiritual refinement, right?
Right.
He has lived a long life, but he has not maybe done the quote unquote alchemical work that alchemy is supposed to point towards.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, fascinating, and so cool to see how all of these things are connected together, and that it all remains very relevant, even though we're going back to very ancient ideas, and also like even looking forward to very current, but also even futuristic notions. Really cool. Well, John, tell us, what are you working on next? What are some of your upcoming projects that we can be on the lookout for?
Well, as I mentioned, I'm working on this book on alcohol in the Bible. I say alcohol rather than wine. Wine's obviously mentioned the most, but I think there are references to grain-based alcohol, so beer, in the Bible. Yeah, so I'm working on that at the moment, and so it should be out in 2024. That's the hope. It's titled "The Mountain Shall Drip Sweet Wine: A Biblical Theology of Alcohol." That'll be published with Zondervan Academic.
Nice.
I have
really
so
cool.
many people that I already want to give that book to.
Well, and I keep thinking like that, you have to have also touched on some similar themes with that in terms of the
absolutely
the consumption and the life
right.
and death.
Right. Especially because there are, at its core, my interests are about death and mortality and slash immortality, the means of overcoming it and pursuing that. Right. And there's obviously a lot to say biblically about that. There's a lot to say within literature and film, like with Black Mirror, TV show Black Mirror, as I've mentioned. But alcohol is actually pretty central in some ways. Right. You think about the use of wine in the Eucharist, obviously, as an interesting connection there, in terms of our connection to Christ. If you are a Christian who participates in the Eucharist, that's one of the ways that we'll at least think about it within Christian theology. And I'm actually working on a couple of different projects related to addressing the relationship between wine and mortality more overtly in some subsequent work as well. So it's there in the book that I'm writing right now, but that book is more of an overview touching on a lot of different themes and kind of the way that the symbolism functions within different texts and sort of not really addressing permissibility. I think often when you think about a book on something like alcohol in the Bible, you imagine that it's a book about like, can we or can't we, or should we or shouldn't we? And how much
is too much?
Right. And to be honest,
bus driving is drunk driving, right?
Yeah. That's not the book I'm writing. It's really about how the symbolism works and functions and how there's different types of symbolism. So I like to refer to the varietals of how wine functions, to kind of use a little pun there.
Yeah.
That it doesn't play the same role in every individual setting. Sometimes it represents actually quite drastically different things, and so do other metaphors. Yeast is a great example if you're familiar with biblical literature. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the expansion of yeast represents the expansion of something good, but sometimes it represents the expansion of something not so good.
A little yeast leavens all the dough. Yeah,
right, exactly. And if we're talking about the kingdom of God as in one parable, well then it's a great thing. But if we're talking about some aberrant teaching, well then it's not a good thing, right? So that's the metaphor can work in different directions. And so I think similarly, actually probably even more so, wine functions in quite fascinatingly nuanced ways throughout the Bible.
Well, that's really cool. Well, thank you so much, John, for joining us on the show today. How fascinating to have you come talk to us about all that you're doing with Harry Potter and beyond. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you both so much. This was an absolute delight. It was wonderful to be on the Potterversity podcast.
Oh yeah, so much fun. And you have to do something for next year so we can bring you on again.
Oh, I would love to. In fact, the thing Harry Potter related that I want to work on, I haven't really started, but I would like to talk about the moment when Dumbledore and Harry are in the cave and the Inferi are coming after them. Oh. And Harry's sort of giving Dumbledore the drink. I want to talk about Gethsemane and the cup that Jesus refers to, and kind of do some intertextuality there. So that would tie together some of my alcohol research and Harry Potter stuff. So that's where I've been sort of ruminating presently.
Do it. You just sent my mind into overdrive.
Do it. No, I find that such a powerful scene. And, we don't actually see a lot of in-depth analysis of it. It's a tough scene. It's tough.
Right. It is tough. It's pretty horrible. That would be a hard one to live with while you're doing your research.
Well, I've been choosing a lot of tough passages in Harry Potter for a while now.
Yeah. Well, given the seriousness of our topic today, I thought perhaps to end on a lighter note with our closing quote. And this is from a conversation between Harry and Ron as they're listening to the tale of the three brothers being told in Deathly Hallows. "Death's got an invisibility cloak?" Harry interrupted again. "So he can sneak up on people," said Ron. "Sometimes he gets bored of running at them, flapping his arms and shrieking." Keep it interesting, dear listeners, and look out behind you.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburnd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburnd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.